Welcome to the Siemens Digital Industry Software Energy Podcast, a discussion on energy and the digital challenges before us. My name is Brennan Conley, and in this series, we'll chat about a number of topics regarding digital and its impact in the energy, chemicals, and infrastructure markets. Today, we have John Nixon with us, the global strategy lead for Siemens DISW, with over 29 years experience working in energy and utilities. Also with us today is John Lusty, Portfolio Development Manager at Siemens, working with Canadian energy, chemical, and mining businesses. For this first episode, let's discuss the good and the bad we have seen around sustainability and where we see opportunity for Siemens to contribute to this. John Nixon and John Lusty, thank you so much for joining us today. We've heard a lot of conversation and news back in March regarding SVB, its failure, and their significant bets on ESG. What are some of your thoughts on this recent event?
It's an interesting subject, Brendan, because there's a lot of different angles we can look at it. But to me, it's a great example of how customers are getting smarter, right? And we're seeing that across not only the financial industry, but the energy industry. And with Silicon Valley Bank, or SVB, as they're known as, customers had woken up to the fact that, you know, their deposits are getting about 0.5% interest, but in money market funds, because of interest rates really around the world going up, they could make 4 to 5% in money markets. So why not pull the funds out of that savings account, put it in a money market fund, get a better return, right? It's not a huge leap to get to that. So where things started to go sideways is those customers started withdrawing assets faster than expected, right? And SVB had been around for 40 years. They knew what they were doing. There were smart people at that organization, but the plan started to deviate. So SVB had to sell assets, which are, you know, in a bank are bonds and T-bills, to try to keep up with the demand, to generate new cash, right? And one of the challenges that we've seen in recent financial markets is that as interest rates go up, bond prices go down. If you hold a bond in maturity, you get 100% of it back plus your interest. If you sell it in advance, that's not the case. And with SVB, they only got about 70 cents on the dollar for those assets they were selling early, which means they started to incur losses. And those losses mounted and became the end of SVB. And I think bringing it back to energy, it's a really good example of the law of unintended consequences and why organizations, regardless of whether you're a bank in Silicon Valley or whether you're an oil and gas producer or a power generator, the law of unintended consequences applies. And there's a need to maintain that agility, that resiliency to be able to evolve and change as the market demands. And companies have really got to be able to anticipate what's coming at them and be ready for it. And that's sometimes not what they expected when they started the project.
Absolutely. And Brendan, I'm glad you brought up this question here in this podcast. When people are talking about ESG, it represents a fundamental transformation for our species. We had the internal combustion engine. We've had great innovations as we've moved through industrialization. We've had mechanization and electrification and automation, and now we're into digitalization. And all of this now supports this sustainability, this mindset that our species has taken on, that we're not going to consume every drop of oil that the earth has before we decide that we're going to rethink how we generate, transport, store, and consume energy as a species. So even though you have events like this and people try to draw a hard line between it and maybe investments they made in ESG, at the root of it, as John was just talking about, ESG is not the root of this challenge. So I'm excited about the fact that ESG, and I'm living through this transformation, because we should all ask ourselves a question: in one or two or three generations, is the main ingredient for our children's and our grandchildren's food going to be plastic? Is the main source of energy always and forever going to be crude oil? Well, the answer is no. And we're going to make that change now as a species. And it's going to take a lot of digital support. And here's the exciting thing. At the same time that we've recognized we need this transformation, we also have digitalization at an inflection point where things are moving to the cloud. And there's no limit on the amount of flops now. I mean, for all intents and purposes, there's no limit to what you can put towards these challenges when it comes to computational power. I mean, John Lusty, look at artificial intelligence. You know, in our careers, it was always this kind of dream, this dream. And now it seems like almost overnight, AI is on the tip of everybody's tongue. And we are addressing that in everything we offer as solutions. So it's real exciting what we live in. So yes, we have events like SVB. Yes, they're going to cause us to pause and ask ourselves, are we heading in the right direction? But overall, yes, on balance, we are moving in the right direction as a species.
Yeah, and I think you've got a really good combination of the digital twin supporting those physical projects that are happening at the plants, right? Because depending on their business model, owner operators need to have both one hand on the lever of the physical assets and the other hand on the lever of the digital assets. They need to be able to coordinate the advantages that both give them to really optimize those results so that we can meet our 2030 goals and meet our 2050 goals and the reporting requirements that are going to go with them.
And Brendan, one other thing, and this will be my last point. I know you've got some other questions for us, but when you ask about recent events, this impact on our thinking around ESG and sustainability, you know, I also look at the fact that right now there's roughly about $4 trillion globally in chemical sales. And that's looking to grow by 2030 to something on the order of about $6 to $7 trillion in global sales. So does that mean we're going to build that many more plants? No. What it means is process intensification. It means we're going to have to rethink the volume and the quality of inputs, the volume of energy consumption, the amount of waste that we're going to produce in that process, the disposition of that waste. And then we have to look at the consumption, the end use of the products produced in those chemical sales. And that's just one industry of many. That's a great example of you can't carpet the entire planet in solar PV. So there's going to be this balancing act we're going to be performing as a species. And a lot of that's going to be around efficiency and driving a different mindset as to what our expectations are in performance of assets.
Yes. So I think this is a great time to dive into decarbonization. This is an enormous engineering challenge. And I'd like to ask the both of you, if you were running an energy company today, what would you do to address this challenge?
That's a great question, Brendan. Decarbonization, which I think a lot of times is used as a term really for the sustainable footprint, the posture, you know, for a company, what would you do to address this challenge? And so I think about the supply chain. Because you often hear about scope 1, 2, and 3 along the supply chain. What is your actual footprint? What's the footprint you create by the type of power and inputs you consume? And then scope 3, which is, you know, that subsequent use of your product or the transportation of it and so forth. What are those knock-on effects outside of your firm that you create because of the business that you're in? For me, when I think about the supply chain, I think about measurable traceability. Now, what do I mean by measurable traceability? If at any point in your supply chain, who you're sourcing from, the transportation of those materials or raw items, be they chemical inputs or equipment for a project, whatever it might be, you have these inputs, you're then going to transform. You may be assembling a plant together in a project and so forth. So you have the waste that was developed and the emissions that were developed during the production of the assets on the project. You've got the actual waste and the emissions you have during the actual build stage. And then you go through commissioning and startup. And now you've got the long-term footprint. What's the measurable traceability? And again, when you say measurable traceability, what are you measuring it against? And how valid is that measure? Are you truly saving X number of tons or millions of tons or billions of tons in carbon? I'll give you an example. In the United States, I think it's 23% of waste is produced by the construction industry of solid waste. Now, that's a pretty big number. And there's something on the order of about 2.2 billion metric tons of solid waste that the construction industry will produce between now and I think it's 2026 globally. So in other words, we've got a waste problem. And so that which gets measured gets accomplished. So you're going to have what you consider to be a reliable, and by the way, recognized measurable traceability. Now, there are standards out there, and there are companies out there that are relied upon as third parties to provide you what I consider that baseline against which you're being measured. So if I were running a company today in energy as an energy enterprise, it's that triple bottom line, right? People, planet, profits, right? You don't have to sacrifice one or the other. You need to do all three. And so when you think about the planet portion of that, just like I do with the profits side, I have, you know, generally accepted accounting principles, right? I have a yardstick against which I measure my financial performance. You need to have measurable traceability that you can go to the markets with and demonstrate your true footprint, that you're reducing and designing that waste out of your processes. John Lusty, that's what I see. I see measurable traceability as a big challenge.
It's going to be interesting to watch, John. And I have a lot of conversations with people in the business right now, and everybody's trying to get their heads around completing their projects to meet their 2030 and 2050 goals. And I think, you know, as in the previous question, the devil's going to be in the details, right? And how are things going to evolve? We know the targets are still evolving. The legislation's evolving. You mentioned scope 1, 2, and 3. We're starting to hear about scope 4 now. So I don't know what comes next, but that's continuing to move. But what I talk about with clients now is the systems that they're working to decarbonize are going to generate massive amounts of data, whether they're from new assets that are generating performance data at the edge, whether it's field assets that are generating data that field operators are collecting as they move. We're going to have massive amounts of data associated with tracking those emissions. So I think customers are going to be challenged to understand, do they have all the data? Is it complete? Is it correct? Is it consistent? Is it secure? Right? These are new issues, I think, that are going to become more important because, like everything, in the financial industry, you probably heard of this concept of the activist shareholder, right? That can get in and look at the details and start asking tough questions. I think we're going to see the same thing when it comes to the compliance reporting that's going to be happening in conjunction with decarbonization. So just like, you know, in other areas of the business, we're used to doing water balances and energy balances. I think this notion of a carbon balance is going to be an important one, and it's going to have to be rock solid from a data standpoint, because we've seen examples where people with agendas can, what I like to say, cherry pick the math. We're not going to be able to cherry pick the math. If we're really intending on making a difference and meeting the goals for our organization and meeting the goals that society is expecting from an industry as sophisticated as the energy industry, as we move forward to 2030 and 2050, and applying the amount of data that can be generated and doing things with it, as you're suggesting, John, traceability to understand how it's all related is going to be a big piece of the puzzle in terms of how we're going to get there. But it's going to present a certain amount of challenges too. So there's going to be an ongoing project right until we get to 2050 and beyond.
Excellent, John. So I hear you discussing measurable traceability and requirements management for ESG. What's your opinion on that? Would this potentially be a perfect starting point to focus on?
When you consider already the volume of requirements and the risks that they address in energy capital assets and the assembly of them during projects or during operations and maintenance, the requirements are already very difficult to get your arms around. If I talk about, you know, let's say my prior experience in this industry, over the last 30 years of my career, I can say requirements have always been managed very manually. And I've worked for the super majors, I've worked for majors, I've worked across wastewater, midstream, as well as mining and oil and gas. And almost consistently, the amount of rework to ensure that you're meeting requirements during the design process, the mistakes that are made in the field during construction that you have to recover from, because again, requirements weren't adhered to during the design process, or they changed. Because, you know, many of these projects take years of procurement and assembly and then commissioning and startup. To get your arms around just requirements is a great first step, because now you're adding into that all of these sustainability requirements. So if you're in the design process, how do you know if you're meeting the requirements of balancing out the cost of the asset versus its footprint? And you might have to sit here and make trade-offs between, well, I could buy it halfway across the world and it's cheaper and it's still the same quality, but my footprint transporting it all the way to my project site is huge. Or I could source it locally and it's more expensive, but my carbon footprint is minuscule compared to what it would be. Well, you have to make sure that you understand what the requirements are. And I can tell you they're becoming more stringent around sustainability. So you have to be able to account. And I'll tell you, when you think about requirements, you shouldn't think about these voluminous documents. Every requirement's an object. And that object should be associated with an asset. because that asset is part of a system, and that system is part of a system of systems we call a plant. And again, this goes back to your prior question, Brendan, when you asked, you know, what would you do as, like, say, a current modern day energy company? I might ask myself, can I even get my arms around the industry standards, my clients' specifications, the litany of requirements that I already have in addition to sustainability? And how do I ensure that there's traceability, there's good orchestration of those requirements throughout my design, build, commissioning, and eventually operations and maintenance environments? So I think requirements is one of the very best places you can start. John Lusty, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I totally agree, John. You know, we've seen example after example where major projects in, hey, it's not even unique to the energy industry, right, have gone over scope and beyond their schedule, right? Because they didn't have a solid grasp on how they were going to break down each of the requirements for a project, which varies depending on the business model that they're pursuing. But what is an owner-operator expecting at a very, very granular level to be delivered back from their contractors and their supply chain to meet the requirements of the project and have it successful? Or if you're part of that supply chain, you know, how do you take that contract that you've been awarded from an energy company, break it down at a very granular level to understand each unique requirement that you can deliver on or need to deliver on in order for that to be aggregated up and be successful? And extracting, you know, sentence after sentence after sentence and building really big spreadsheets, John's probably not the way to do it. You mentioned treating each one of those business requirements as an object. So now you're bringing the power of the digital twin to help customers better manage all of those requirements so that they can report on them, they can status them, they can go back and have do the right level of due diligence very quickly if there's a dispute somewhere down the line. It's a really good approach to take. And customers, depending on their business models, right, whether you're an owner-operator, maybe you're an engineering company, decarbonization, at the end of the day, it's just an engineering project. There isn't a widget you can buy that solves the decarbonization problems. It's really the beginning of a new engineering project. And if we take a step back and say, well, if we were kicking off a new engineering project today, what would we do differently? And I think that requirements management approach is an excellent place to start. That doesn't always happen in this industry. I think people should take a step back and say, okay, we're talking about digital twins a lot. What do we really want to do with it? Because that forms a subset of the requirements in terms of how is the project going to be designed? How is construction going to be executed? You know, how is data handover if I'm the owner operator? What am I looking for my supply chain? Because they need to know that up front, and it probably needs to be in the contract. So if they're expecting to get what they asked for, right, John?
One of the things you remind me of is in my career, I was working on a mega project, and it was roughly a project over about 5.5, almost 6 years, about $8 to $10 billion. What was interesting was on this project, they had to hire somebody full time, and their only job was to go back and find out where mistakes were made in the specifications that were issued versus the version that drawings and other design work was done. And what I mean by that is we would find that equipment that had been designed, shipped to the field, was at different elevations and different configurations for the necessary flanging we had to do to connect all these modules up. Turns out over the course of the many years, the owner operator was changing specifications, and those weren't being communicated rapidly enough because, of course, prime contractors are under a lot of pressure, right, to get their portion done, the design work, because we got to get procurement done, because we got to get to first, you know, wind or first oil or where, you know, whatever your energy is you're going to produce. You got to get there and get there quickly, because the day you start doing that is the day you start making revenue. So you're under that kind of pressure. Well, that pressure is not going to go away. So how do you do it better? Well, you need requirements lifecycle. And you remind me of the fact that we have the ability with public and private clouds to be able to provide an ecosystem now where you can digitally integrate your requirements management, those objects, with your design processes so that when you do update requirements, it's immediate. Everybody's on the same ecosystem. Everybody's logging in to pull that data. And if it changes in the background, you're not worried about whether some internal memo with a binder clipped to it made it out to some construction trailer somewhere and people realize that, oh my gosh, our specs have actually changed. Okay, so that kind of requirements lifecycle on the cloud is game changing. And I'm real excited about what we're seeing. Now, John, I'm going to ask you a quick question. You had shared a story with me, and I always find this interesting, but it's an example of what digitalization is not. I think you worked with a major contractor, and we don't want to necessarily say the name, but this prime contractor told you they had done a survey of how many spreadsheets existed for one of their mega projects where they went through and surveyed the number of active spreadsheets they used, their contractors used, and then what their owner operator was using. And in combination, this was all being used on this mega project. Do you remember what that number was?
Yeah, it was approaching 500,000 spreadsheets, John. We love spreadsheets because they're so flexible and we can do so much with them. But at the same time, they're prone to error. They're not secure. They can walk out the door on a thumb drive. You can have copy and paste errors. It's just not the way to get control of your data, right? So, you know, you were talking about adopting a requirements approach and how there's no time to think about this once the project is awarded, right? Because I had a customer say to me, as soon as that contract is awarded, the train's already left the station. You need to think in advance. What is your strategy going to be in terms of how are we going to deliver 100% on this project? Or how am I, if I'm an owner operator, know that I'm going to receive 100% of what I'm requiring on this project, right? That has to be thought of upfront. And as I mentioned, what does a digital twin mean to me? How do I plan on using it during the engineering and construction phase? And what value does that present to me during the operations and maintenance phase? And have I thought through how I'm going to efficiently obtain that information? Because you can bet the owner operator who's on the receiving end of a few hundred thousand Excel spreadsheets doesn't have the manpower to be able to organize that, right? It's just going to become digital landfill. So the stuff has to be thought about up front. And that's where I think bringing it back to decarbonization, given that you can't run out and buy a piece of software called DecarbSoft, or you can't buy a decarbonization widget, they're all projects, right? And you know, in this industry, we've learned a ton in past decades in terms of how to execute successful engineering projects. Everybody is going to have new projects to meet their sustainability requirements. How are we going to do them better? What are we going to do different? That's a great question, right? And how can we use the power of the digital twin to set ourselves up for more successful operations? And then, you know, something we haven't talked about yet, John, is how are we going to take all that information and efficiently hand it over and make it available to the next generation? Because we have a massive knowledge transfer project coming our way. Because as you and I have talked about, the baby boomers are going to retire in increasing numbers every year until 2030. They've started already. That transition is going to peak in 6.x years or whatever we're at now. And then it's going to start to decline. All that information we receive from our contractors, how do we organize it so that it's available to the people that we're going to hand over the keys to the company for, right? And they're going to continue to operate these operations that are so important for what society needs in the decades to come. These are really big questions.
Those are great questions for our next podcast. But on this one, where we're talking about sustainability, and we look at like some recent headlines, and then we think about the fact that as a species, we're transforming. And then where do you get started? And there's even bigger conversations on depending on where a company's maturity is and where they can get started. Yep. If you at least think about requirements and how do I ensure that my design requirements, the testing requirements I have to perform in the field, like hydro tests and x-rays and ultrasounds, how am I gathering all that data? How do I ensure that the physical reality that I now see operating or constructed in the field matches the digital twin and the requirements that I was tracking against every asset and then every system and then every system of systems? So there's a lot more to talk about, but Brendan, this was a great opportunity to spend some time with you and just have a quick chat about sustainability and its impact for our energy, our digital energy enterprises in our market.
Absolutely, John. And John, this has been great. Thank you so much for your time today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Stay tuned for our next episode in the series coming really soon.